As the U.S. commemorates its centennial of entering World War I, KCSB reporter Amerika Raffanelli speaks with historian Kenneth Hugh about the geopolitical landscape leading up to the war.
The world in the maybe 25 years, maybe more, leading up to World War I was, especially if you're talking about the Western world and Europe, and you can throw Russia in there as well, too, depending on, you know, how you define that. But they're all sort of moving in a similar direction in terms of colonization. It is the 1880s, especially, and 1890s was a time of rampant imperialism. And they talk about it being a scramble for territory and a scramble for resources that were out there. And by the time that you get on the other side of the century mark, you get into the 20th century, early 20th century, there's a few colonies left. And there's a real sense in a lot of these European nations that there's nothing left for them to grab onto anymore. And they're all very worried about, you know, where their resources are going to be coming from, whether or not one country is going to have the upper hand over another country. The other thing that they're doing is this is during the Second Industrial Revolution, which the United States is also participating in. Although I should say at the onset, the United States is watching these developments, and for the most part, they think that they are outside of the events. For the most part, that they think that they're above this. They're watching what the Europeans are doing, and they're kind of they're a little disgusted. Although the U.S. is also involved in its own imperialism going into Cuba and then the Philippines in the 1890s. So all of these countries are competing with each other for territory. They are trading with each other, but there are trade wars going on at the same time. And so there's a big part of them that is building up their industrial might in terms of armaments. And so there's a major arms race going on, specifically between Britain and Germany at the time. And where it's most acute is the battleship race. So the British, for at least a century, you know, throughout most of the 19th century, were considered to be the masters of the oceans. You know, Britannia rules the waves. That's their kind of national anthem, as it were. The Germans are competing with them now. And so the British are feeling that, you know, there's pressure on for them to stay in stride. And so the British have actually come out with the kind of premier battleship of the day. And the Germans are, you know, trying to match that. So the idea is not necessarily at the time that there might be a direct conflict with between the countries, but maybe through their colonies somehow. But all of the countries in the world are doing this. You know, and there are a few observers who are looking around and saying, well, what happens when you consistently build up your armaments and your armies and you prepare for this conflict? At some point, there's going to be a break in that. And so, I mean, that's brings us up to about 1911, 1912, and then you have the Balkans, which was a kind of notorious area of Europe. There was a lot of infighting, a lot of borders had changed over time, and a lot of ethnic rivalries, and that is really where World War I is going to start. That's the powder keg, basically, that leads to it. And you know, without going into too much detail, there are a lot of little wars down there. And there are different sides that have, you know, their dog in the fight is one of the Balkan countries, and that includes the Russians, who the Russians have been smarting since about 1905 because they lost a war to Japan, and that was very embarrassing to them. And I just mentioned this too. A lot of these countries have internal social problems that are going on, and so they are war. Sometimes is unfortunately it's a way to take the focus off of domestic problems and focus on maybe a common enemy. And so the Russians are looking to do that. The Germans certainly are trying to take a certain amount of steam away from the growing socialist movements that are through and communist movements that are popping up. And, you know, so all of these countries have all kinds of ulterior motives. They're looking for to increase their greatness in the world. They're looking to increase their power. And within the Balkans, the Germans and the Austrians have a sense that they want that to remain a Austria-Hungary controlled area, and the Russians would like to see some of their Slavic, basically the way they looked at it would be like little brothers, you know, get more freedom for themselves. But then that would aid the Russians. And so they basically both have, maybe not strict allies, but they have an interest in it. and through an assassination that happens in 1914, which is of the Austrian Archduke Franz Ferdinand, by a terrorist organization known as the Black Hand, the Austrians basically issue an ultimatum to the Serbians that they better either turn over everything that they know about this terrorist group and the perpetrators of it, or they will invade. And when the Serbians drag their heels on that, that launches basically the Austrian invasion. The Russians start to mobilize their forces. And the Germans, who have been looking for a war because they're looking to increase their national greatness. And there was actually, even within Germany, there was some sense that there was going to be a major, even almost apocalyptic war that was going to put Germany on top of the heap. This is in part because the person who is running Germany, at least the monarch, is a very paranoid individual named Kaiser Wilhelm II. And he sees plots everywhere. He thinks that Germany for many years has been encircled. And it was part of German history that, you know, during the Napoleonic Wars, the French would invade and go back and forth, and Germany sort of became a battlefield. And so he was trying to do away with that and to increase German power, but has this very kind of dark view of the rest of the countries in Europe. And so was one of many who decided that the best thing that could happen to Germany would be a major war where they would take the first shots and then eventually win the day. And so that is the geopolitical situation that is existing up to 1914, in August of 1914, when war starts to descend on Europe. All the major countries who are involved, England, France, Germany, Russia, and Italy to a lesser extent, but they all thought that they were going to get something out of this war. And I should also mention, it is you have the Ottoman Empire, which is, you know, one of the many empires that will actually crumble because of the war. They all thought that this would be a good thing for them and that it would be a short war and it'd be over by Christmas and there'd be a lot of war stories to tell, but then there'd be more money and territory and, you know, they it would look good for the rulers of these countries.
So obviously the U.S. gets involved eventually. Can you explain the quote-unquote ludicrous scheme that supposedly prompted U.S. involvement in World War One?
Yeah, so the U.S. is watching all of these developments. They're not oblivious, obviously. They're rather worried of what's happening in Europe. There are strong factions that exist within the U.S. that would like the United States to get involved in World War One. One of them is led by former president. So former president Theodore Roosevelt, who lost fairly famously in 1912, he made a bid to become president, running on as a Republican, but as his own party for the most part, running as a bull moose. He loses in a three-way race, and the winner of the 1912 election is Woodrow Wilson, who was he was an internationalist, so not strictly an isolationist, but he also didn't believe that the United States should get involved in the war. So there are these factions. There's some that say we should get involved in some respect. At least we should aid the Allies. And in this case, the Allies are specifically France and Britain. And there's this long argument. And the British are trying to make this too, by the way, that the United States and Britain have a long friendship and that they have common cultural roots and language and whatnot. And so they need to aid each other. Well, the United States is very cautiously watching the war, and what they see for basically 3 years is some of the worst industrial carnage that has ever existed. It's some of the battles of World War One are just impossible to understand, you know, compared to battles that had existed before. So battles that last the rage for months, you know, sometimes nearly an entire year. And hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people are killed in these. And they're battles of basically stagnation, where troops on either side, Germans and the British and the French, and I should say that World War One is a global conflict. So you'll have soldiers coming from all over the world, some of all these colonies that had been imperialized by these nations. They will send soldiers, you know, from Africa, from Asia, and whatnot. They will be India. They'll be fighting alongside their allies there. But what's happening is they're dying in just almost impossible to comprehend how, you know, the vast amount of death that happens because they're basically in trenches, which was this an old idea. It was almost an American idea, you could argue. And this is what we had done during part of the Civil War. But you dig holes in the ground if you don't want to give up your position, and you you basically fortify it as much as you can. So trenches could be anywhere from waist deep to, you know, well over your head. They might have bunker systems involved. They were using a new technology called barbed wire, which was used before to keep cattle in place, but now was used to keep men from taking land. And they will also use things like machine guns, which had been used in combat against colonized people before, but now is being used against, you know, the creators of this technology, you know, with horrifying effect. And, you know, we talked today about the horror of chemical and biological weapons, you know, what happened in Syria recently. Well, this is when you have chemical weapons really being unleashed on populations. And it's the Germans who do it first, but the British and the French will use them as well. And so, I mean, this is what the United States is seeing happening in Europe. And if there was a reluctance to get involved in a European fight beforehand, seeing how many people are dying and the ways in which they're fighting is really probably the main thing that is scaring most Americans. By the way, Americans, at least up until our involvement in World War I, we're getting pretty good news about it. We get a lot of a description of the atrocities and the things that are happening over there. So it's pretty scary. And I should background this too by saying that Woodrow Wilson, who was elected in 1912, while he is an internationalist and does believe that there should be some kind of international cooperation and an international discussion, he is also well aware that since George Washington was president, there is a longstanding belief that the United States does not get involved in European affairs. For trade, yes, but not especially not when it comes to war. The young country, the young republic, had almost been destroyed or severely wounded when the British and the French go to war after the Revolutionary War. And, you know, that had impacted us severely. And it was thought for a long time that the United States was too weak to go anywhere near it. We'd never get anything good out of it. So that was a longstanding argument that, you know, some would say, well, maybe that was old-fashioned by the 19-teens, but it's a tradition. It was very hard to go against. And so throughout 1914 and 1915 and really into 1916 and part of 1917, there was a very strong anti-war, even pacifist movement in the United States. And it gave rise to things like popular songs. I Didn't Raise My Boy to Be a Soldier is one of them. You know, that was a very popular song that was sung at the time. So that's what Woodrow Wilson and others, you know, who are maybe seeing the danger that is coming, and the danger of sitting out maybe of a conflict on that scale, that's what they would have to somewhat work against. But Woodrow Wilson in 1916, one of his campaign promises is that he kept us out of the war. As the war is raging, the United States is making money off of that war. We were selling armaments to, well, at first it was whoever can get over here, basically. So if you can come over to the United States and purchase these, you can, and you give us cash, basically. You know, we're not going to loan you anything. You give us the money for it. You can take whatever back. And it could be the Germans or it could be the British and the French. Now, once the Germans enact a naval blockade against landlocked, for the most part, landlocked Germany, it's almost impossible for the Germans to come over. So what the Germans have done, though, and this is one of the factors that's going to lead to the United States taking issue with how the Germans are fighting and starting to color American opinion against Germany, was the Germans don't have much of a fleet, and most of it is bottled up in the North Sea. What they do have are submarines, and many countries had them, but the Germans were the ones who were perfecting them, and they called them U-boats. And the U-boats were weak vessels when it came to running on the surface. Where they excelled was obviously in stealth. And so they were, you know, secretive, and they would use torpedoes, and they would use them against warships. But oftentimes, and what the Germans increasingly were doing in 1915, were going after passenger ships. Anything that could have a storage that could be used to ship weapons or materials that would aid the British and the French was considered to be a legitimate target by the Germans. And in 1915, they're going to sink a ship that has a lot of Americans on it. It's called the Lusitania. And you could think of the Lusitania as a pleasure craft, very similar to the Titanic, not the same company, but similar in size and has similar kind of luxury compartments, whatnot. That is sunk by the Germans. And Woodrow Wilson will come out in 1915 arguing that freedom of the seas was a longstanding right. Americans had always had this kind of the neutrality of the oceans was supposed to be upheld. And to do this was a dangerous kind of turn and basically forced the Germans to stop doing it. And so they will abandon that. That was called unrestricted submarine warfare. So they reserved the right to target any ship, no matter what flag was being flown and no matter if it was a military ship or a passenger ship, with the argument that even a passenger ship could be aiding the Allies. The reason why the Germans did that in the first place was because, again, if a submarine is on the surface, it's very small compared to these ships. You could ram it. They're very slow. They don't have a lot of maneuverability. The old rules of warfare were that you would go to the, you know, you would signal a ship and you would, you know, raise a flag and say that we were boarding your ship. And then you'd give kind of a memorandum to the captain of the ship. And they'd say, you know, we will be sinking your ship in 20 minutes. You know, get the lifeboats ready. You know, just, you know, warn everyone on board. That went out the window with the use of submarines. And so the only thing that the Germans had were stealth in that regard. So they will abandon. They will stop using submarines against passenger ships and neutral ships from countries that were not involved in the war from 1915 to early 1917. But by 1917, things have gotten very tense for the Germans, and they feel like they're on their last, the last of their legs. You know, they're on the ropes, and they have a gambit to try to win the war.
That was KCSB reporter Amerika Raffinelli speaking with Kenneth Hugh about the events leading up to World War II and the major players involved.